I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. We're going to go in order of the agenda today.
Oh, my gosh.
We're going to try to. We'll see how it goes.
A moment of silence, please.
And with that, we also will not be working House Bill 2005 today, so if those of you that are just staying for a work session, that won't happen. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2005.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that you heard February 22nd that makes the unlawful employment practice of discriminating against employees based on protected class when paying wages or other compensation. You now have before you a -5 amendment that came from Representative Leininger. It replaces the original measure, but I'm going to describe the differences between the amendment and the original measure. It defines compensation to include equity-based compensation. It redefines work of a comparable character, and it replaces the term wages with wages or other compensation. And it applies pay equity provisions to people with disabilities. It allows the employer to consider compensation of their current employee during a transfer, a move, or a hire of the employee to a new position. And it removes the proposed amendments to the OLFLA and the Oregon Sick Leave Act that would have required no loss of seniority when a person is on leave. The -6 amendment that is before you, and both of these amendments are on OLIS. The -6 amendment comes from Representative Barreto, and the difference between the -5 and the -6 are as follows. It applies pay equity provisions to discrimination that is based on race, gender, and age. It eliminates the proposal to allow a private right of action for any violation of pay equity claim made under Chapter 659A. And I want to point out that Legislative Council will be changing that amendment to remove the erroneous cross-reference to Chapter 659A that occurs in Section 2 of the amendment.
Thank you. So up first, Representative Leininger. Might as well, Kate Newell, Whitney Stark, and Trish Garner. Probably.
Thank you. Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you for having us back today to talk about the -5 amendments and this important bill in general. I'm Ann Leininger, representing House District 38, Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I have another committee I need to get to that starts now, so I'll be very brief and turn it over to my good colleagues. But we have done quite a bit of work since we were last before you to develop amendments to address some of the input that we have heard from community members, and Ms. Newhall will walk through, from our perspective, these amendments. Ms. Stark will provide some additional insight, and then batting cleanup for us, we have Ms. Garner, who will talk about, from her perspective as someone who's worked on pay equity issues for a very long time, the fact that it's important that we take strong steps forward this legislative session. So with that, I'll defer to my colleagues who are subject matter experts, and thank you, and thank Representative Bynum and Representative Lively and everyone else who has worked hard to help us move this bill forward with what we believe are very strong -5 amendments.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall with Family Forward Oregon, and we're happy to be here today in support of House Bill 2005 and the -5 amendments. I feel like Jan already did a very good job of what my role in this hearing was to be, which is to go through what the -5 amendments do, but I'll still do that. The -5 amendments are, yes, prepared as a gut and stuff, but do a couple pretty simple things to the bill. The first thing it does is it makes a change to the definition of compensation, and it replaces what used to be the words stock options with equity-based compensation. And the reason we did this is my understanding that this is a better way to encompass the different types of stock options that are typically offered. The -5 amendments also add workers with a disability to the list of protected classes that must be paid equitably for substantially similar work. We believe this is an important protection for workers with a disability who, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, make 64 cents on the dollar for every dollar their colleagues without a disability make. It also adds a provision for internal hires only and allows employers to use salary history for determining compensation and to inquire about the salary history when they are making an internal hire or promotion. We believe that this is fine, presumably because an employer who is making an internal hire already knows the salary history of that particular employee. It also does some slight rewording to the definition of work of comparable character, but we think that these are non-substantive changes that achieve exactly what the original definition did. The last difference in the Dash 5 amendments is that it removes references to sick time and OFLA and provisions that would have required that you don't lose any seniority while you are out on protected leave. So it takes that provision out entirely. We believe that House Bill 2005 is an important step to ending pay equity inequity in Oregon, and will help break the cycle of pay disparity that can trap women in lower wages lower than their counterparts over multiple jobs, and wage gaps that compound over the course of their career. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to offer this testimony on the Dash 5 amendments, and happy to answer questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Stark. I'm an attorney. I practice employment and labor law. So I'm going to briefly, just very briefly, talk about what the bill does, and then talk about what the bill does not do, what it, and kind of try and address some of the concerns that I've heard out there about this bill. So, as hopefully we all understand by now, that the bill provides important protections to employees by expanding the protections to all protected categories, not just gender, and prohibiting an employer from using past compensation of a potential applicant, an outside applicant, to set the compensation for a position or requesting the salary history for that same purpose. It also makes several clarifications to definitions within the law that should make it easier for an employer to administer the law. Now, nothing in the law prevents an employer from asking a job applicant about their past work performance, from considering specific information about job past performance. So, for example, if you have an employee who is in sales and you want to understand their sales history, you're still entitled to ask applicants about that kind of job information and performance related issues. Nothing in the bill prevents you from asking an applicant what their desired salary is, or asking, making inquiries about market rates and market information about salaries, or negotiating salaries once an offer is made. Similarly, the bill allows an employer to pay employees differently based on any bona fide factor other than their status in a protected category, such as is subject to the language in the bill, but a bona fide factor would include location. So employees who work in Ashland and employees who work in Portland, you could pay them differently. This bill does not prevent that. There is a language that is built into the bill for exactly those kind of purposes. It also permits employers to pay employees at different compensation levels if that difference is based on a merit system. So that means that an employer is permitted to take an employer's work performance into account and when they're setting compensation levels. With regard to the expansion from gender to all protected categories, that this should be an administratively simpler thing to do for the employer. It means that employer is not separating gender out in the way it's tracking or paying compensation, but should be paying everybody across the board based on the same factor. So that should be make it an administrative simplification. Additionally, the proposed amendments do not change the burden of proof on how the bill from how the bill currently operates. They do not make the burden of proof any higher than you have in the current bill. And it does not. There's nothing in it that otherwise that makes it more difficult for an employer in terms of burden of proof. The bill does strengthen the remedies, which is very important. It the strengthen remedies and allow an employee to be able to made whole if they are harmed by discrimination in their pay. So that is an important addition that this bill, these amendments add. And finally, these amendments also do make clear that it's a new unlawful practice each time there is a continued paycheck that is unequal in pay. And that's an important provision that makes the Oregon law equal to what the kinds of protections that you see under federal law, where under federal law you have similar types of protections. And so if an employee chooses to seek just remedies under Oregon law, they would have the equal remedy and equal time period to seek that. Thank you. I'm also happy to answer any questions about any of the technical issues I just discussed.
Thank you. Go ahead and finish, and then we'll have questions.
All right,
at the end
thank
of the
you.
Panel.
I thought I thank you. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Trish Garner. I am the state public policy chair of the American Association of University Women of Oregon. AUW's commitment to fair pay and pay equity has been longstanding. I can also say my personal commitment, which has lasted some 40 years, to pay equity is also firm. Unfortunately, the problem of pay inequity is equally longstanding and persistent. Interestingly, with respect to AUW, our first national convention was held in 1892 at the National Museum in Washington, D.C., which now is known as the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, which some of you may have had a chance to visit. Virtually the first issue the convention addressed was pay inequity, the result of which was a study published in 1896 that clearly documented that women were paid significantly less than men for doing the same work. As I sit here today, some 125 years later, I can unfortunately say the same thing. Women are paid significantly less than men for the same work. This disparity has continued not only through world wars and economic downturns, but economic good times. In my conversations with members of our organization, it afflicts women who've been in business, who are engineers, who are software developers, who have advanced degrees, who are cashiers. It's also in particular a problem that I've discussed with a number of members where they come to retirement and it is only then that they realize that for the past 20 years that they have been paid each paycheck less than their male counterparts. You may have heard some oppose this bill because women choose lower earning jobs or professions or that a motherhood penalty is justifiable. To this, I would say plainly and simply, the data do not support these assertions. They're just plain wrong. As legislators, I don't envy the times when you have to choose between two bad options, or perhaps even more challenging, between two good options. This is not the case today. Instead, you have the opportunity to endorse what everyone agrees is moral and right. People should be paid the same for the same work. Why can employers pay women less than men? Because they can get away with it. There's only one thing a woman should have to do to get paid as much as a man: her job. Let's clear away the noise and recognize that no matter how many times we have to say it, all the citizens of Oregon, women, men, and their families deserve to be rewarded for their work fairly and equitably. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you. I urge you to support House Bill 2005. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the panel. We spoke of including individuals with disabilities in this legislation. Aren't there statutes that specifically allow people with disabilities to be paid less than minimum wage? And how would the proponents of this legislation reconcile that with this bill?
Thank you, Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd. I believe there are federal laws that allow certain workers to be paid less than minimum wage, although I'm not totally familiar with those provisions. But what I would say is that one of the things that the bill does allow for is workers to be paid differently based on merit. So if there is something, and I think a lot of these are the sheltered workshop type production facilities. And I think in these instances where you might have a worker with a disability only able to produce not as many widgets as a able-bodied worker could pay, that would be something that would be allowable under this bill because it's a different in merit and I think would be allowed.
Thank you.
I'll just add, there's also a similar provision, not just based on merit, but on merit, but also based on the quantity of production. So if their output is less because they have a serious disability and are in a workshop type of environment, I think there's provisions in the bill that would account for that.
Quick follow-up.
Thank
you. So I guess it's fair to say that if an employer can prove why they've made this adjustment or call based on what you said, output, what have you, capability, that the legislation still allows that?
That would be my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Just thank you so much for coming back, and thanks for coming and visiting me. I really enjoyed our time.
Me too.
One of the things that I am curious about or a little bit concerned, have we looked at a fiscal at all for what this might have an impact on our state, cities, counties? I can't imagine that they're perfect. I can't imagine that they are doing this all right either. And I'm wondering if we've done... if we spend any time possibly looking at a risk assessment based on what they may be needing to take care of as well.
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, I guess I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. Is the question that there would potentially be increased complaints against city, county, local governments, or is the question that they would incur a fiscal because they are paying inequitably and they would have to rectify that?
Can I follow up? Is that, can I answer?
Follow up.
Thanks, Chair. I would say possibly both, because I doubt that they're perfect and are paying women what they ought to be paid either. So I'm probably both.
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, I have not seen the fiscal impact on this bill.
We do not have the fiscal impact statement, if that's what you're asking, at this point. It hasn't come in the last few minutes, I don't believe.
Well, may I, Chair? And I didn't see one either, and I just raised the question simply because I think it's valid. And I think if we're looking at the private sector and saying you're not complying, and we look at data with the amount of public employees that we have, I would bet that they may be in this bucket as well.
And I guess I would just say to that I think that pay disparity is not just anywhere that it happens. And if it is incurring a fiscal because city, county, state governments are having to change their pay dynamics to make sure that everybody is being paid equitably, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Can I follow up?
I guess that we will see that when the fiscal gets posted. You know, we will see much of that impact to states.
And is it okay, Chair?
Follow up.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, so please don't take it that I'm trying to say that that's bad. I'm just saying it's something that we should also be making sure that we're aware of. So I don't want you to feel like I'm saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying we should be thinking about that.
Further questions? Another one, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would speak to Rep. Hack's point that we're not arguing that that's a bad thing. If there is an injustice being done to women there, then we need to fix that. But it would help the legislature with possibly not investing in other investments, since we do have budget issues, if we know ahead of time that there's going to be possibly a $1 billion blowback from what would be basically fixing an injustice in our state. So, just saying.
Just saying, no questions. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony and walking us through the -5 amendment.
Thank you.
So this, we're still in public hearing. I didn't see anyone else signed up to provide public testimony under public hearing. So with that, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2005. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2843.
Hi, committee members, this measure, chief sponsor is Representative Evans. This measure directs Oregon OSHA to study the potential safety benefits of screening replacement workers during a lockout, a strike, or other labor dispute who are employed by a company that's employing 100 or more employees in an industry involving hazardous materials. It directs the division to report to the legislature by September 15th, 2018, and it defines what hazardous materials are.
Representative Evans.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to introduce this bill for us?
Yes, I would, Chair. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, one of the prettiest districts in the state, which includes Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, South Salem. And this bill is really, it shouldn't affect anybody currently, but it is designed to try to bring some clarity to a problem that was recognized over the last couple of years. In a little bit, I believe the director of OSHA is going to come forward and talk about some of the specifics. But the situation is this. During a lockout, so again, during a labor negotiation where the company has said, all right, we're not going to accept the suggestions. We're going to actually lock people out. And that doesn't happen often, but when it does, sometimes the employer will actually bring in replacement workers. Again, that doesn't always happen, but sometimes it does. The situation 2 years ago in Albany with a company that I think everybody knows the ATI story. Anyway, the problem was once that process began, several of us were made aware of the concerns due to what's made at that particular manufacturing plant, concerns about replacement workers coming in. They didn't understand the equipment, the age of the equipment, or some of the safety aspects. Now, again, the people that made me start researching this could have retired and I think actually did end up retiring anyway. They were more concerned about the long-term health of the community because the making of titanium is not exactly one of the easier processes to do. And some of the equipment was aged. Some of the folks were very clear that the equipment was finicky. And when you're dealing with hazardous materials or explosive materials, finicky is generally not a good thing. So when I asked if OSHA could actually say, all right, again, not getting involved in whether the could or should on the lockout piece, but are the replacement workers actually trained? Can we make sure that they understand the makings of titanium? They said that'd be nice. We really don't have anything, any tool to do that with. So then I asked the fire marshal. I said, hey, no problem. Understand. Maybe OSHA can't do it. Can the fire marshal go in and make sure that the materials handling process is correct? I said, well, that'd be nice, too, but we don't really have the ability to do that. So what this process does, really, this bill is offered to try and provide OSHA with the ability to do some research, look at what steps can be taken, and actually, unlike a lot of our bills, it wouldn't require them to come back to the legislature to pass a series of recommendations. They have some administrative authorities to act, but they want to do it in a very measured process. So that's what the bill's about, trying to make sure that if there are companies in the future, especially as we get into a more technologically driven 21st century, we don't have half of Albany blowing up by accident. That's all there is to it.
Representative Doherty, question?
Yes. The scabs that were brought in, were they trained at all in the because that's just, steel is a very highly trained profession. Were they trained at all, or do you know?
Chair Hovey, Representative Doherty, training was reported to have been done. Mm-hmm. again, the particular nature of the titanium process at that plant, which involves a number of chemicals that I can't spell, much less pronounce well, there was great concern that folks that have worked in other manufacturing plants with similar equipment really may not have known the tricky nature of dealing with the titanium. So I don't know. This process would actually ensure that in the future we would absolutely know and we would absolutely have a sense of certainty. So again, however the process unfolds, we would at least be secure that accidents wouldn't, again, in this case, blow up part of Albany.
Okay, thank you.
Or any other city that we're talking about, not just Albany. I don't want to pick on Albany.
Thank you. I know there's more questions, but I'm wondering if we should bring up the OSHA director first and let him talk, and then maybe the questions can be addressed more holistically. Not that you're doing a bad job.
Well, I would welcome the OSHA director to come up, actually.
Yeah, Michael Wood.
Do you want me to sit here with you, or want me to go hide?
I'm fine.
Good afternoon. You have signed up on the witness sheet, so go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to simply as Oregon OSHA. I did sign up. We do not have a position on the bill. However, I did want to indicate, as Representative Evans has already indicated, that in the event that we were directed to do the study and our analysis concluded that there was a heightened risk and a reason to take a look as part of our scheduling system, we have the administrative authority in rulemaking to be able to make that change. So as he indicated, if the conclusion of the analysis was that there was reason to look more closely at such a situation, we'd be able to address that without coming back for further legislation. And beyond that, I guess I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Bynum, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question for the panel is, what interest exactly does the state have in screening any employer's employees rather than just ensuring that safety information is transmitted whenever a new employee comes on the job for whatever reason? I'm not convinced that a strike is the only reason that the state would have an interest in making sure an employee is safe. And for the record, I believe an employee is an employee, and I don't subscribe to SCABS, the term. So,
I'll start. You
okay?
Again, first of all, labels are important in this particular case. It wasn't a strike; it was actually a lockout.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
That's important. The second piece is, I think the state's interest is making sure that whatever activities happen within our boundaries don't end up accidentally blowing people up. And I spent 7 years as a firefighter watching people who thought they were experts with things hurt themselves and others. In this particular case, because, again, of the specifics of the titanium-making process, you can mix chemicals in a way and mix processes in a way that can have unanticipated consequences. So that extra level of care of that employee in that particular place, I think, is warranted when the impact or the risk of the impact of an explosion that can impact the community in such a scale is a question.
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, as I indicated, the department does not have a position on this bill, so we're not here to promote a particular viewpoint. However, you're right. All employees are entitled to protection. They're entitled to protection under the Oregon Safe Employment Act. If we were to do the analysis of the benefits of screening, we would be doing it in the context of that law. So we would be looking at safety and health issues and safety and health training. It is certainly possible from a conceptual standpoint, and there is some literature out there that any time that there is a large-scale replacement of workers for any reason, that creates a heightened risk. Obviously, there's a heightened challenge whenever you have to deal with training all of your workers at once. And that's the context in which we'd be looking at the issue. That's the analysis that we'd be trying to do, and that's the context we'd be addressing the question.
Follow up.
So you're saying that you don't have the jurisdiction or authority to do it on a large scale at this point, and that's what this bill would allow you to do, or you're able to do that now in the interest of the public health?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, our jurisdiction, strictly speaking, is worker protection. So one of the oddities of our jurisdiction is our concern, if there's the risk of a plant explosion, is the workers in the plant. We wouldn't be looking at it from a broad public health standpoint, but we do have jurisdiction over occupational health. When we were asked the question specifically about looking at this facility, the question was whether we could go in essentially on our own motion. If there was an incident that brought it to our attention, if there was a media referral, if we had received a complaint, had there been an injury, there are things that could have taken us in. Under our scheduling system, we're directed by this body to identify those places of employment that are determined to be the most unsafe and to focus our resources when we do programmed inspections, scheduled inspections, to focus our resources on those places of employment. This situation does not fall within that scheduling parameter, so it wasn't something that we could essentially do because it seemed like a good idea. It didn't fall within the rules. It wasn't action we could take.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my understanding down there at Albany was that they brought in employees from different plants that were already trained in the process to replace the workers that were on lockout. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, what I understand is that most were employees or had been employees of the parent company, but not all had been involved in that particular type of manufacturing, and that was the problem. Some had been involved in manufacturing. ATI has a number of plants across the country, but not in that particular environment and making that particular product.
I have a follow-up. Yeah, and in other industries like foundry work too, there are risk of explosions. You know, and the company takes the risk, and along with the employer, along with the insurance companies. And so, would this not be better served by the insurance companies rather than OSHA?
Chair, Representative Barreto, I think in terms of after the event or post-event blame and or compensation, yes. The situation is if there is a possible way to prevent an event before it occurs, that's what I was trying to get at. Because at the end of the day, again, because of previous experiences, I don't want to have to know that folks got hurt because we could have prevented it. And again, only in the rare situations where it's a lockout. This is not a company doing business every day. I mean, there's processes in place for that. But when things have gotten to the point where communication is broken down officially and businesses are trying to basically, in this case, keep things going as best they can, I would not expect everybody to be that was brought in to have the same level of experience. I just want to make sure that the communities that house these companies are as safe as possible. And hopefully the discovery process that OSHA can go through will actually give us a better answer.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, again, if we are directed by this body to do this study, will we be doing it in the context of our existing jurisdiction? We do have jurisdiction over the safety of the workers in the plant now. And we would be looking at the possible application of that existing jurisdiction. It's in no way a change or increase in Oregon OSHA's jurisdiction over the workplace.
One last quick follow-up. But in this circumstance, there was no accident, was there? After they brought employees in.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, that actually depends on who you talk to. There was not a large-scale accident, but there were reported, or at least I'm told, of several very close mishaps. And that's, again, why I didn't let it drop after a year. I was reminded, again, by folks who the company status has changed. A lot of folks are no longer even in the business. But they were just concerned for precedence purposes to make sure that in the future people aren't put into situations where they may not have, I mean, again, they're trying to do the best job they can. They may not know the equipment, and an accident may occur.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Wood, so given a scenario where there was a lockout, and in this one I did have conversations where there were injured workers from things that were did blow up. Evidently, they didn't file a worker comp claim, or you weren't notified of those injuries. Otherwise, you probably could have taken action. And so my question is, had you been aware of injuries that were taking place by a total new workforce within a company performing, you know, some hazardous jobs, and there was an accident, would you have the authority then to go in and screen whether the workers were properly trained?
Chair Holvey, it would depend on the nature of the injuries and the circumstances that led to them. If they result in a hospitalization, that's actually a mandatory report. And if that came to our attention by another means, that would result in an inspection almost automatically. If we found out through the workers' compensation system, if we happened to find out that an injury had occurred, and it was not an injury that triggered a mandatory report, but in the circumstances it was clear that it could have. Sometimes we find out about those things through the media. There's a media report. We can treat those as a media referral and go in on that basis. The other place where we frequently find out about those things is that they generate worker complaints, and they're included in the body of the complaint, and it's part of what we evaluate when we make a determination about how to respond to the complaint.
So if there's an injury and there is somebody is sent to the emergency room, does that qualify as hospitalization that would you would then become aware of it?
Chair Holvey, no. The hospitalization reporting requirement requires an admission for an overnight stay before it is triggered. So it would not necessarily be triggered by an emergency room visit.
Thank you. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To OSHA. So if you were doing an investigation, hypothetically, and you were interviewing different individuals that, for instance, were working on making titanium, what gives you the confidence that your personnel would fully understand what makes someone qualified, not qualified, safe, not safe? I've known nothing about titanium. That's why I'm curious.
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, that's a very good question. One of the things that we struggle on generally is that we are generalists when it comes to the practice of occupational safety and health, and we're frequently put in the position of evaluating the expertise of individuals whose expertise, if they're properly qualified, has to exceed our own. It is possible to evaluate the level of training and expertise of an individual. Most of us do it in our own lives when we're deciding whether or not to hire a CPA or deciding whether or not to hire an attorney. And so it has to do with the type of questions you ask. We ask questions about the training. We ask questions about the nature of their training. We ask questions about the nature of their experience. Those would all be part of evaluating whether or not they had the experience and training that they needed. We'd also look at whether they were familiar with the chemical properties that actually are fairly well documented on the safety data sheets. So there are some hazards that a trained health and safety professional knows where to look and where to find them, and we can ask workers to see whether they are generally aware of them, which is one indication of whether they've had training and how well that training has stuck with them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
No one else signed up to testify on House Bill 2843. So with that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2843 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2975.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure brought to you by Representative Malmstrom. The bill allows a court to award $500 in statutory damages as well as any reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing retail customer who brings action against a vehicle dealer with a claim of fraud or fraudulent representation or violations relating to the vehicle code. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. So let's have Seamus Linsky.
Linsky.
Adam Hansen. And Young Logan King. Oof. You hear that?
That was correct.
Yeah, that's working. You nailed it. You said that to me.
Pretty proud of yourself.
I am. I never get a name right. So sorry for the diatribe. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please? Whoever's going first, doesn't matter.
My name is Adam Hansen.
And you have testimony to give.
I do have testimony to give. And if we'd like to jump into that, we most
certainly can. That's what we're here for.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. So, as I said, my name is Adam Hansen. I am an attorney. I specialize in consumer protection, specifically helping out consumers who have been wronged in a vehicle transaction. I'm here with my partner, Mr. Young Walgenkim, and we're both going to make some comments in testimony today. And while we don't have much to say, we want to make ourselves available for questions. We did submit some testimony earlier, and I assume that's been received. A couple of exhibits as well. I've provided some copies of that if anybody needs that today. So, that.
So excuse me. So this bill addresses many problems with them.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Young Walgenkim, supporter of this bill, and it addresses many problems, but the main problem is Oregon consumers are buying cars from dealers and they're not receiving title. So we've seen the delays from 3 to 6 months, but it's been as long as 2 years. Some Oregon consumers never receive the title. And just to show you how prevalent this problem is, our submission exhibit A, this is a this is from the Dealer Details magazine. DMV puts this out every quarter and goes back to 2011. And it shows all the dealer sanctions from 2011. We've highlighted all of the sanctions related to title transfers. And if you look, half of all these violations are yellow, more than half. This is by far the highest majority of dealer violations. Exhibit B that we submitted, this is 2016 consumer complaints to the Oregon Department of Justice, the financial fraud section. Just for 2016, there are 37 complaints about dealers failing to provide title. And DOJ isn't even the agency that handles this problem. So, and you might ask, well, how is this happening? Well, what dealers do is they often purchase cars on credit. So they haven't paid for these cars. But they're allowed to turn around and sell them to consumers. That's fine. That's part of the law. Law allows that. But what happens is when they sell these cars and the consumer pays money or upfront, or sometimes they finance it, it doesn't matter because the dealers themselves, they get paid in full for the cars they sell. What they're supposed to do is they're supposed to take that money and pay for the car that they just sold. But they don't do that. Oftentimes, they put that money into their rent that they haven't paid or payroll or different things. And so the consumer doesn't get the title because that lien hasn't been paid off. And it just they just get pushed along and along. And meanwhile, the consumer has to pay for all the trip permits. They never receive title. I mean, there's a lot of times they can't even drive this car.
And to add to that just a little bit, this frequently accompanies dealerships that are out of business or going out of business, which severely limits the consumer's ability to find any remedy at all. You know, if they return to the lot where they purchased the vehicle and nobody's home, there's not a lot they can do. Luckily, dealers are required as part of the licensing process to be bonded. There's a surety bond out there. And what this bill would allow us to do is to allow recovery to be received from the bond to the same extent that it would be able to be received from the dealer itself if they were in place, as well as the statutory penalty. So just some minor changes to what already exists. And you know, we're not trying to hide anything here. This practice is already illegal. You know, they have to deliver title according to the rules that are already in existence. But it allows that consumer to have some sort of remedy and also have access to an attorney to help them solve their problems. That's Seamus.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Seamus Linsky. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Consumer League, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2975. So as they've laid out, the reality is, best case scenario, there are dealers out there who are simply procrastinating. Worst case scenario, they're using those funds for other purposes. And the end result is the consumer is left without a title for their car. Now, the state doesn't really have the resources to prosecute these cases, and that's why it continues to be such a prominent problem. A private right of action will allow consumers to go after the dealers themselves, but without any teeth, it's sort of a meaningless provision. And so HB 2975 sets forth a $500 remedy plus attorney's fees. And it's really that leverage of attorney's fees that's going to be that's going to give HB 2975 the real threat it needs to get these dealers to pay off the liens and give consumers their title. So that's why I ask that you please vote yes on HB 2975.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Barreto.
Yeah. How many times a year did you might have mentioned this? How many times a year this happens in Oregon where people buy a car and never receive the title?
My name is Young Walgen Kim, and we don't have the numbers to how many times a year, but there are 37 complaints to the DOJ in 2016 alone, and they're not the agency that deals with this. And I didn't go ahead and count every year's violations on the Exhibit A, but all the ones highlighted on the right, it tells you how many counts of those offenses that's been sanctioned. So there are dealers who haven't shown up on these that they have violated, but DMV just doesn't have the manpower to handle all of that.
And Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, if I may add to that, in our private practice, we receive phone calls from consumers every day, and this is a phone call that is more prevalent than we would like it to be. We don't have hard data on who calls for what all the time, but it's something that we hear every week. Not an uncommon phone call.
Follow up.
So this scenario here, they would be awarded $500 if they could collect it, and then attorney's fees if they could collect it from someone who's already gone out of business or whatever. So what happens to the car they purchased without the title? They've got a bill of sale, a receipt for it, but then someone else out over here is holding the title to that car that the dealer bought, or maybe there's two transactions in between. So what obviously, they don't get to keep the car if someone else has the title to it.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, this is a situation that we've handled in the past for a handful of our clients, and we have a couple here today who will testify a little bit later. We have been able to obtain titles for these individuals through legal process by working with the lien holders, other people who may have an interest, a prior inferior interest in the title. So by representing the consumer's interest firsthand, we've been able to obtain every title that we've looked for our clients so far.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Question or no question?
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Appreciate it. Up next, can we have Francine Beck? And how about Shina Hoosh? Hoosh? Hoosh. Didn't get that one right. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
My name's Francine Beck, and I'm from Lane County. I live in Vida, Oregon, which is east of Eugene. Recently, my husband Rich passed away with no life insurance policy. Knowing it'd be several months until I received death benefits, Social Security, or any pensions, we lived on what we had in the bank and credit cards. When my benefits arrived, they came in a lump sum, and after receiving nothing for several months, I decided that the best use of that money, after cremating my husband with what I had left over, that I would buy two cars for my sons, for our security. I paid cash for both of these cars at the same dealership within 2 days of each other. I also bought warranties for both cars. As time went on, I received no title in the mail. I continually called the dealership. The owner was never available. There was always a tape. Then it got so bad that it was just mailbox full. I then received a letter from the warranty company stating that I had no warranty because the dealer had never paid the money I gave him for the warranties on the car. I tried contacting him again. He eventually answered the phone, asked me if I would fax him the warranty letters so he could take care of this. I waited about a week, got nothing in the mail, called the warranty company. They still had not received the money, and the warranties were still no good. At this time, I still had not received the titles in the mail. I continued to call him, and at the very end, basically, I called DMV to see about the titles, to see what they could do to help me. She said I could buy a temporary trip permit for 21 days for $30 for each car. I could only do that twice in a 12-month period, meaning my sons could drive those cars for $120 for 42 days. She suggested that I contact DMV Investigations, which I did. She also gave me some really bad news about both of these cars. She basically said, I'm going to have a really hard time ever getting these titles. One was not even titled in this state. She said that she may be able to help me with a 90-day extension on the tags for nothing, but she suggested I get an attorney. I called two or three attorneys asking if they could help me on a contingency basis with no luck. She said, I may want to use this time to continue looking for one so that I could get proper titles. I'm on a limited income. I knew I couldn't afford an attorney. I gave that dealer everything I had. I feel like I'm going to end up with nothing. Two cars that will never be driven. No legal titles. And I pretty much just feel like I let everyone down. And I will never recover that money. So that's what happened to me.
Thank you for sharing. Go ahead.
My name is Shayna. I'm from Aloha, Oregon. I'm testifying in support of the Dashwan Amendment. I have been fighting for nearly 2 years to get my title and registration for my vehicle. I purchased my car from a dealership in Portland. I paid cash for the car, including the registration fees and title transfer. I was told that my title would come to me in the mail in about 3 weeks' time. Since then, the dealership has given me several different scenarios of why they haven't gotten it to me yet, including that they lost the title and were trying to get a replacement. However, from the research that I have done on my own time, I found that the dealership I purchased my vehicle from bought it from an auction, but never paid them off, resulting in no title for the dealership. They have closed business and reopened under several different names and flat out have refused to help me. Over the course of the 2 years, I've reached out to the DMV and I've done what they've suggested me to do by reaching out to the previous owner of the vehicle, an attempt to get a bill of sale, and reaching out to the finance company that has the lien on the title for a lien satisfaction form. I've provided the finance company with the documentation requested of me, and now I'm getting the runaround from them too, saying that now I need to contact the auction house the dealership had purchased the car from. After several attempts to reach them, I have yet to hear back any response. After 2 years, the DMV is at the point where they told me their hands are tied and they can no longer help. All the while, I've never received my title or my registration and still don't have plates for my car. I have no proof that I own the car aside from the bill of sale from the dealership. I've sought out several attorneys. Two of them gave me no responses. Two of them told me there was nothing they could do. Luckily, I was able to find a lawyer, Hansen and Walken Kim, who were willing to take my case pro bono and help me get what is rightfully mine.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Seeing any questions, I do sympathize and empathize with mm-hmm. the situation you've been in. With that, it's got to be really, really frustrating. So appreciate you coming forward and providing your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Up next, Greg Rimmensperger and Daryl Fuller.
Thank you, Chairman Holvey. For the record, my name is Greg Rimmensperger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, representing the franchise dealers in the great state of Oregon. We are all in favor of corralling bad dealers, and to hear these kind of stories just breaks your heart, because that is a black eye for our industry. For the most part, our members as franchise dealers don't fall into the classification of those types of transactions, because the biggest asset that they have is the franchise agreement. And the manufacturer, if they saw the dealer doing business like that, would pull their franchise, and they no longer have a viable business at the level that they do. The investment that they have to make in infrastructure and facilities and equipment and tools to be able to represent the manufacturer is a substantial investment. And so to do that type of a violation is tough. When we're talking about title violations, if you look through the list that they provided, the majority of those that are, franchise dealers, it's a delay. It's not a failure to provide title. And there are some issues with DMV being able to, and banks being able to turn titles around. Typically, those are resolved sometime after that 30-day window in a short period of time. But again, I think it's the exception to the rule where they can't get a title. They're required, all dealers, all dealers are required to know that they've got access to the title before they sell the vehicle. So the ones that are selling without are in violation of that rule. However, there are cases where you buy a vehicle through auction and you don't actually physically have the title yet, but you've got statement and power of attorney of clear title before you go. Our issue with this comes not from the standpoint of trying to solve the issues that we've heard here today, but more that it also opens up an opportunity for a double down on attorney's fees on UTPA claims, Unfair Trade Practice Act claims. The most of the claims against a dealer's bond are things that have to do with UTPA issues, which already provides a settlement as well as attorney fees. So if you have this type of a situation come in where they could get double down on that, damages in two different cases plus attorney's fees in two different classifications, we think it creates an opportunity for some aggressive trial lawyers to go out and get a nice little practice based off of the ability to do this they were to prevail in their settlement. Even if it was just a no dollar settlement or a dollar settlement, they could get double attorney's fees out of that. So our concern is the opportunity to create frivolous lawsuits that would be brought to the courts, really with very little to lose, unless, but big to gain if they win.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, testifying in opposition to House Bill 2975. Would like to provide a little bit of perspective, if I could. The attorneys who testified previously in the second paragraph of their testimony, one sentence reads, "The money they, the dealers, receive for the car they sold should be used to satisfy the prior lien on the title, but it frequently is not." And I want to take issue with the notion of frequency. There was a question about how big this problem is. They didn't have that information, so I'd like to provide that to you. In 2016, in the state of Oregon, there were 1,172,444 title transfers. Of those, approximately 40% of them come from dealer transactions. So that's approximately 468,000 dealer sales in the state of Oregon. The Department of Justice has 37 complaints. I didn't do the factoring on that, but that's a pretty small percentage. If you looked at the information that the advocates for the bill supplied, the 40-some-odd pagers of DMV regarding DMV investigations, and just look at the 2016 numbers, because the numbers they have go all the way back to 2011, you'll see somewhat, and I didn't get a chance to add them all up. I just sort of did it on the back of a napkin, if you will. But for 2016, and I looked at all of the complaints, not the ones that they'd highlighted, there were something around 1,000 complaints against dealers against 468,000 transactions. So we're looking at about 0.25% of sales where DMV is contacted and does some sort of investigation. So the notion that this is a frequent problem, I think, is probably a bit exaggerated. My colleague had indicated, in most of those cases, you will find that the dealer has sent the letter or needs to send a letter, in the cases that they don't, to the consumer saying there's a delay in getting your title. The reason most frequently that a dealer cannot get a title to the consumer is because the dealer has paid off the lien holder and the dealer is waiting for the lien holder to release the title. The reason why that takes a long time is that the financial institutions aggregate all of the titles for the vehicles that they own nationwide in a warehouse someplace, Hoboken, New Jersey, or, I mean, wherever they do, right? But if you pay off a U.S. bank or if you pay off a Bank of America lien on a car, it's not going to your local bank, and they don't have a drawer there with all the Oregon titles. Right, that payoff goes to a payoff house. The payoff house sends a notice out to the warehouse, and the warehouse goes and gets that title, and then the warehouse sends that title to the dealer, and the dealer then has to get the title transferred and sent to the customer, and that doesn't always happen within 30 days. We have actually found instances where financial institutions are taking the physical titles that they receive, and they're secure documents, and they will scan them, and they will hold them electronically, but they will shred the actual document. So when the payoff comes, they can't send you an electronic copy of the title because it's a secure document. So the lien holder then has to request a replacement title from DMV. DMV has to send the replacement title to the lien holder, which is the bank, before the bank can then release it back to the dealer. So of the 1,000 per year cases in which a customer does not get their title in a timely manner, I would guess that somewhere in advance of 70% of those, maybe closer to 80 or 90% of those transactions, are because the dealer has paid off the financial institution, and we're just waiting to get the title so we can get it to our customer. Now, all of that doesn't change the testimony of the people who were witnesses prior to us. There are people that get ripped off. And as my colleague indicated, nobody is more frustrated with those circumstances than legitimate dealers who don't like the black eye that comes from people who don't operate legitimately. The question comes, is House Bill 2975 the solution to that problem? And unfortunately, it's not. And there's two things that they mentioned that I think are important to mention. First, there is a bond out there, so if you don't get your title, you can file a claim against the bond, right? And in theory, the bond should pay out that lien that the dealer didn't pay so that the customer can get their title. So if that's not happening, then perhaps there's an issue with the bonding company in terms of getting the payouts. The bond in Oregon is currently $40,000. Along with the New Car Dealers Association, the U-Car Dealers Association, some years ago, we changed our bond so that at least 50% of it, 20 of that $40,000 bond, can only go to consumers. So other businesses can't come in and claim against most of that bond. Half of the bond goes only to consumer complaints. But the big issue and the complaint that the advocates of the bill had, which we agree with 100%, is that DMV is understaffed to do the work that they need to do. There are 7 investigators for the entire state of Oregon when somebody files a complaint against a dealer. And they're set out regionally, and their job is to try to not only check to make sure that the dealers are doing things on spot checks, but they're going after illegal dealers and they're responding to consumer complaints. We're advocating, even though we're in really tough economic times in terms of the state, because the DMV business regulations has sufficient income from dealer licensing fees to hire additional investigators, we think DMV ought to be given the authority to hire additional investigators so that we can get rid of the bad dealers quicker rather than waiting so long to shut down dealers that have gone bad, and so that they can help these consumers do what they need to do without having to go find an attorney. But the solution is not $500 and attorney's fees, because in most of these cases, as was mentioned, the dealership's out of business. The attorney is not going to get attorney's fees if the dealership is gone and they can't get those titles. So I'm not even sure that the $500 damage and attorney's fees is going to cause more attorneys to take more of these cases when they realize that there's no money there to get the judgment from. So while I certainly appreciate the hard luck cases when people do end up at a dealership where there is no money there, providing attorney's fees and an extra $500 from a dealership that no longer exists doesn't solve the problem. Giving DMV the resources they need to go after dealers before things get so bad that customers get harmed,
Great.
And so that there's enough investigators there so that they can help consumers get the titles they need through the bonding process, would be a much better solution to the problem. And I apologize for taking so long. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So just for clarification purposes, I'm trying to understand the bond piece. So if a consumer were to have, say, a $10,000 car, and could it be that the attorney, and this is, I don't know if they get their money from the bond or if they have to go through and just get it from the dealership, but could it essentially be that you have a $10,000 car and end up with $30,000 in attorney's fees? Could that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, I don't know the answer to that question, whether someone can get attorney's fees through a bond process, because I don't believe you have to go through a lawyer or through a court system to apply against the bond. So in many, and I would argue in most cases, I don't think an attorney is even involved. Through DMV business regulations, they should be providing assistance to consumers in terms of how to apply against the bond and making sure that the consumers are getting the restitution that they need.
And follow up.
So
I think what I'm trying to get at is, could you have a situation where you have a $10,000 car and it ends up costing $30,000 in legal fees to actually recover the title? I mean, we obviously have a problem, and people, like you said, there are bad actors out there. So is there a way to have a piece of legislation that holds the bad actors accountable, but caps the fee, does something to...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, I don't know the answer to your question in that under these cases, and in a lot of cases, what you're going to have, and it depends on how much people pay for the cars, obviously, so they could have paid $5,000 for the car, they could have paid $30,000 for the car. What attorneys charge to advocate on behalf of these cases, I don't know. I don't know what the average attorney fee would be, but there certainly would be cases where I assume the attorney fees would be higher than the actual cost of the recovery.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. For either of you, do you know who Shannon Jones is?
Chairman Holvey, Representative Evans, yes, I do.
Why don't you tell me why Shannon Jones is a name we should all know?
Well, Shannon is actually the son of a former franchise dealer in Corvallis that went out of business when General Motors pulled their Chevrolet franchise when they were in bankruptcy, when General Motors was in bankruptcy. And so Randy shut his dealership down, and his son came in and took over the dealership and was running as a used car dealer after that. And he got a little upside down, I guess is the best way to put it, in his financing, and was turning over vehicles to his flooring company, turning over VIN numbers that he was stating that he had in inventory to offset the value of the flooring loan that he was getting from his lender on vehicles that they had already sold. So when everything started to eventually catch up with him and consumers when the dealership was being shut down, they went back after it, the lender went back after it to collect the cars that were listed on the flooring company that he had previously sold. So this is a case of bad actor scenario.
Two follow-ups. First is, do you know where he is now?
Chair Holvey and Representative Evans, no, I don't.
Chair it in Federal Correctional Institution.
A good place for him.
The follow-up last question is it possible, just possible, that there's actually more than 1,000 affected, but most people don't go to a lawyer? I ask this because I'm one of the people that actually was cheated by Mr. Jones, and I didn't go to a lawyer. I know a lot of people that don't because they don't have the time, energy, or money to actually attempt that, and I think perhaps, possibly, just possibly there's more than 1,000 people impacted by this.
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I certainly think that would be correct. But I think if you were to take the 1,000 complaints in 2016 with DMV business regulation, multiply it by a factor of whatever you think is reasonable against almost 500,000 transactions, and we're still talking about significantly less than a single percent of the transactions. And again, to put it into that perspective, if you're one of those people, it doesn't matter how big the smaller how big or small the problem is, because you're one of the affected parties. My only argument is I'm not sure that this bill is the solution to that problem.
Okay. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today and testifying. You talked about franchise lots quite a bit and taking a lot of statistics from that perspective of a lot. But what about the style of lot that, I mean, in my mind, correct me if I'm wrong, most of these claims would come from non-franchise, small, independent used car lots, would they not?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, yes, I agree with that statement.
Next question is, so when it comes to a bond, is it similar? Oh, follow-up, sorry.
Follow-up.
Getting ahead of myself there. When it comes to a bond, does it work similarly to a business liability insurance policy? If I paid for a bond or liability insurance policy back in 2010, but I'm no longer with them or out of business, is that bond company on the hook for liabilities that I've created for them, similar to my previous liability insurance company, or is it somehow different as far as those claims?
Chairman Holvey, Representative Hurd, I don't believe that they are. Daryl, you might be able
to. Actually, they are. They are. It's the four corners of the bond. So if you have a $40,000 bond for activity in your dealership for the year of 2016, then that bond company is liable for anything that gets claimed in 2016, even though it's several years later, if the transaction happened, as long as, obviously, right, you've got statutes of limitations and things like that that go into it. But the bond is good for the period that the bond was intended to be for. And if I might also comment on your first question, there are about 300 franchise new car dealers in the state of Oregon.
Right.
There are about 2,500 independent car dealers in the state of Oregon. So while there might be more claims against independent car dealers, it's because there are so many more of us and more transactions. In terms of a transactions per volume, I'm not sure that there would be a significant difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to the bond, though, do you gentlemen find oftentimes that bond is insufficient for the liabilities that come up for these independent use small car lots?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, when I started in lobbying on behalf of car dealers in 1996, the bond was $15,000. It is now $40,000. So we're making some upward progress. Representative Evans has a bill in that would increase it to $100,000. The problem with increasing it that quickly is that you put an awful lot of good businesses out of business. But I certainly would agree that the bond needs to continually adjust up. I'm not sure how many claims against a bond where the bond has been exhausted versus those where the bond was sufficient. I don't have that information.
Mr. Chair, one final.
One more follow-up.
So I'm in landscaping, and the way it works for us is the larger the jobs you're going to bid dollar-wise, the higher your bond must be. Is that currently the way it works? If it's not, is that something that would be reasonable to put into that $100,000 requirement? Feedback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, currently it's a $40,000 bond for all dealers, regardless of their size or their volume. That's not an issue that has been proposed in Oregon in the 30 years I've been around, but anything's worth looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. Up next, Melissa Patton and Patrick Patton. And Mr. Walgen, can I probably have you come up for a follow-up question as well when they're done? Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, I'm Patrick Patton. This is my wife,
Melissa Patton.
Go ahead.
We're just here to tell what happened to us. We went down, bought a travel trailer. We went and got a loan from a bank. And we thought we were free and clear. So we did our thing. They paid them off. What was it, a week and a half later, we get a phone call from the owner of the trailer saying that we had to make a deal because he didn't get the money and the place we bought it from went out of business.
As consumers, we were pretty much just left out in the dark. The company was able to close its doors. We called through, contacted the DMV. We were told to launch a complaint, so I believe that was with the Justice Department. It took us quite a while to get any answers. Our bank had no answers and was basically telling us that we had an unsecured loan and they wanted to change our loan. So they were wanting the title. We didn't have title. We couldn't get a hold of the title. And until we contacted...
Well, actually, we contacted somebody with the DMV, and you can't do it on your own. Legal paperwork, we don't understand. So you do have to get a lawyer. And get the legal paper done right.
Yeah, the Justice Department told us they wouldn't tell us anything. We had to get an attorney. So until we were able to contact these guys and get some help, we couldn't. We were lost. We were in the dark.
We couldn't move our trailer. Had to sit. We couldn't drive it around.
And we're on.
We couldn't use.
We were on the end of having the trailer, but the people on the other end, we also felt bad for too, because they had the title and not the trailer. So in our instance, we ended up with the trailer. We still have not received title. They're still working on that. But it's been, it was September 26th last year. So it's been frustrating as a consumer to be left in the dark and think that you can go get a loan, think that your bank's going to help you, and they're not, and then have to get an attorney. And in our case, we were lucky. These guys represented us pro bono. But, you know, we put $1,000 down. We're hardworking people. You don't have time and money and resources to be able to go and do this at a bigger scale. And like you guys were talking about the bond, in our case, I don't know what we're about to talk about, but they did this to a lot of people, and that $40,000 doesn't even touch what they did. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Northwest RV case, but it's a mess, and we were on the other side of it. That's all I have to say.
Can I ask
a question, Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair. And I don't think you can answer, but I don't know if one of the other attorneys might be able to. My original question I was trying to get at with the bond, since there isn't a lot of money in the bond, and if, you know, $40,000 doesn't buy much of a car or an RV, and if half of that goes toward that, my question was, if attorney fees come out of that, then how much actually can go to the consumer? Because I'll be honest, my approach obviously is the consumer. I want to see them taken care of. Not that I don't think you shouldn't be paid for what you do if it's reasonable, but that's what I was trying to get at. I want to know, out of that bond, what actually can go to help the consumer? Do you get paid out of that? Is it only theirs? What happens?
Thank you, Representative Hack, for asking the question of the next panelist, and he's there now. So if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Young Walgen Kim, and Chair Hovey and Representative Hack, I'd like to answer that question. So how these bonds work is, as soon as the bond pays out, the bond company cancels that bond. So if we get a client and I help this consumer out and say, this is how much it is for attorneys, $500 and whatever for attorney fees, once that bond pays out, that dealer is out of business and they have to acquire a new bond. So for the time being, they can't defraud more people. And that's part of why this bill would be very effective, rather than reporting them to the DMV, where they've already admitted that there's not enough manpower to handle everybody's cases. I would also like to update the panel, representatives, and the patents. Actually, we do have their title. We just received it.
That's nice news.
We're all glad to see that. Other questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk about the inconvenience that families go through when they're dealing with their primary source of transportation? So the impact of not having the vehicle for work purposes?
Thank you. Chair Holvey and Representative Bynum, that impact is huge. When most people, when they buy cars, and most Oregon consumers, they don't have a lot of disposable income. So they're relying on this car being available. Well, if they're making payments on this car, $400, $500, $600 a month, and then all of a sudden their temporary permits are up, they can't drive, they can't get to work. I've had clients actually who got fired because they couldn't get to work. Luckily, most of my clients, they can borrow a car. Sometimes they have to pay a little bit of money. Some of them have public transportation available, but that's not a resource that everybody has, and this bill would definitely help them in those situations.
Question again, Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Just to ask, I know no two cases are ever the same, but in general, I think what Representative Hack was trying to get to is, what is an ordinary percentage or a cost of attorney's fees in this process? And the second question I have is, just to clarify, the goal here is not necessarily to become an attorney's program, but rather a way to prevent bad actors from continuing to sell vehicles in bad faith while they're absent a bond.
That is right, Representative Evans. For most of these cases, for failure to deliver a bond, when we send the letter out to the dealer, they say, oh, we're in trouble. We better put this money into that lien first and then pay that off before we handle other stuff. So they wake up and they say, here you go, here's the title. So the amount of attorney fees that would be required is very minimal, somewhere around $1,000 to $2,000 at the most, generally if they behave. Sometimes if there's a huge problem, like Northwest RV case or things like that, but it would be more. But even in these cases, for the patents, there weren't very many hours that was required to acquire the title.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kim?
Yeah, Walgen Kim.
How you say it?
Walgen Kim.
Walgen Kim. They should be paid for. Maybe you just answered it there, but I need to hear it again. So how do you feel like this legislation prevents this from happening?
Representative Hurd, so what happens is when we make a claim for the bond and say, look, you violated this law. That's already a law in our books already. And say, this is $500 in statutory damages, and this is attorney fees. If this bill was passed, then the bond would have no choice but to pay that. Once that gets paid, the bond gets canceled. So if it's a bad dealer, then their bond automatically gets canceled, and they're out of business. They'll have to go and require a new bond, and by that time, during that time, they can't do any business. Now, if it's a good dealer, the bond, when the bond calls the dealer and say, hey, there's a problem, you better pay up. And the good dealer will say, we'll take care of it, and then everything's done.
Representative Barreto.
Really short one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long does a company have to get the title to the purchaser?
So there are many different DMV rules regarding this. For these consignment cases, they have 10 days to deliver the title for the consigned vehicles. But generally, regular car transactions, it's usually 30 days. But if they can't make it, they can send a letter saying, oh, we're going to be late because we're having trouble. And as long as they send that letter, they can get an extension up to 90 days. But 90 days is the very last deadline.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I want to ask a question because I've heard this before. That there's already a process for these complaints, but obviously from bringing this bill forward, the position is the current system makes it very hard for consumers to get their remedies under the current complaint system. And so the private right of action that's under this bill, I assume, is to allow the consumers to go to a private attorney to get their remedies instead of going through a complaint process at the DMV. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, this bill would not strip DMV of their power to regulate these kinds of actions. Actually, the law already allows public, private right of action for these kinds of violations. It just doesn't provide for attorney fees. So when I get calls all the time about the same kind of issue, the title issue. I say, look, I can't help you because it's not fair for you to pay my attorney fees. You already paid everything that you need to pay for this title, even the fees to transfer the title. You shouldn't have to pay any more. And by the way, you don't have the money to pay my hourly rate anyway. So I take them on pro bono, but I can only take a few at a time. And but if this bill were to be passed, then I would be able to help more people. There's a ton of people that were injured by Northwest RV and Shannon Jones. I would have been able to help if we had this bill.
So in the final piece is the other piece that I hear a lot when we're talking about these sorts of things is that this will open up risk to the dealers in this case of frivolous lawsuits, and that you know this is just a way for attorneys to make a living by filing frivolous lawsuits. Is so, tell me why that is or is not true.
Chair Holvey, the rules are pretty binary. There is a deadline. And there's 30-day deadline. If they haven't submitted the title application to DMV, then they violated. Either they're before the deadline or after the deadline. There's really not much room for frivolous lawsuits. And we don't, I mean, our practice is we send a demand letter saying, hey, look, this is what you violated. Pay up and deliver the title. And usually it gets taken care of pretty quickly with the good dealers. And so the idea is, they'll pay a couple of times, and then they'll realize this isn't good business practice, so we're going to be on top of things and actually deliver the title on time, as the law already requires. So,
but I guess are frivolous lawsuits common? I mean, are you able to file frivolous lawsuits?
Chair Holvey, I would get in a lot of trouble if I did file frivolous lawsuits. And not only that, it's not good for my practice, because if I file a frivolous lawsuit, even if I didn't get in trouble, the first thing the defense counsel does is say, this is a frivolous lawsuit, motion to dismiss, I wouldn't get any of my fees.
And what kind of trouble do you get into for filing frivolous lawsuits?
Well, there are sanctions available in court, and probably would have to pay the attorney fees for the defense counsel.
Oh, so there's a disincentive for you to file a frivolous lawsuit.
Yes, Chair Holvey.
Okay, that's... any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Looks like that's everyone that signed up to testify on House Bill 2975. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2975. And committee, I think next up I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2189.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure you heard February 27th. It's a committee bill. It's a measure that establishes the cause of action arising out of real estate appraisal activity that must be commenced before the earlier either of the applicable period of limitation or 5 years from the real estate appraisal activity. It provides an exception when the claim of fraud or misrepresentation is made and applies to causes of action arising on or after the effective date. There is a minimal expenditure impact, there is no revenue impact, and there is no amendment.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Thank you. I know that this is one of the issues that we heard about the supply and demand of appraisals, and this was one that came up that I thought that we could at least get this done soon. So appreciate that. Hey, look, we have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative Fahey.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Representative Hurd.
Yes.
Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2189, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. Who would like to carry this particular bill? Representative Fahey. Thank you. Anything else for the agenda? I did close that work session, did I not? Well, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2189 again. Nothing else on the agenda. House Committee on Business and Labor is adjourned. House Committee on Business and Labor.